So I was also a postdoc here for a couple of years, actually. It's good to be back. So let me start any true mathematics lecture with some definitions. Here. Read them. I'll let you. Thank you. So sort of ironic we're having this prize day today, the day after the Oscars. I'm sure many of you watched them last night. Let's see, who watched the Oscars last night? Who didn't watch the Oscars last night? Someone was on an airplane. It's kind of interesting. So, the Oscars puts one in mind, of course, of TV, which some mathematicians are more addicted to than others. And if you are addicted to TV, or if, like me, you just want to veg out in front of the TV from time to time, if you put your TV on in the evening, there's a very, very good chance that no matter what, this is one of the sampling questions, no matter what station you decide to start on, CSI will be on. So CSI is, for those of you who don't have a television, or don't watch, or don't or have a superpopulation that misleads you, CSI is the new type of detective show where supposedly it's based on some hard science that the detectives use. So the idea is you have a forensic lab that's sitting there in the background collecting the evidence, and they're reading the forensic evidence, and they're able to come up with conclusions that mere detectives can't do. And of course, you've got the interplay between the hard-bitten detective who knows the street and doesn't believe the boffins, and the scientists, of course, come up with evidence that eventually overwhelm even the cynicism of this hard-bitten detective. So I'm sure that what I want to talk about today is the anatomy of the anatomy that you look at CSI, which would be human cadavers, but the anatomy of mathematical objects. And maybe I should say a little bit about the typical sort of plot, actually, of a CSI show. So there's some gruesome murders and very attractive detectives wandering around. And they look at the evidence and, you know, it's baffling everybody what's going on. The detective who's not part of a team goes off on some wild goose chase. And eventually the crime lab, the forensic lab, they look at the evidence and they come up with conclusions that even us, the astute viewer, wouldn't have guessed at from the start. So I saw one episode where there was killings going on all over the place, and the punchline was that there was these two people who looked entirely different, but they were actually twins. So the forensic lab took the DNA evidence and showed they were twins. So one of the things we have there is you can look at things that seem entirely different, and yet, underneath it all, they're the same, the twins. So what we're going to do for common mathematical objects is we're going to investigate them in a different way from we normally do. Now, if you're a mathematician or a statistician, there are objects that you use in all sorts of contexts, in all sorts of ways. And I'm just going to play with two of those very common objects, integers and permutations. And in some sense, what we do in a lot of mathematics is we apply these basic notions. Integers, they're applied in all sorts of ways, counting the number of treatments in an experiment, for instance, and permutations. Maybe you're using the whole symmetric group to count the number of possible ways you can apply your statistics. And in every subject, I could say the same thing. I could come up with some way you use integers and permutations. But, you know, we rarely actually look at them for themselves. We rarely look at their anatomy, what they're made up of. So what I want to do today is to look at the anatomy of these common mathematical objects, integers and permutations, and to try and compare the two of them and try to get some idea of whether they can be compared. So now I've got to figure out how to turn this off, okay? Can I raise this and put on lights, please?
Yes.
Ah. Okay, Tom knows. Excellent, thank you. Okay, so I'm going to take you through Anatomy 101. Oh, okay. So what does that mean?
I think it's a problem because things don't try to push it up and down.
Okay.
So you can write on it, but after you finish writing on it, I guess.
Just remind me if you see. Sudden dangerous moment. Okay. So how are you going to compare two things that on the face of it look extremely different, integers and permutations? I mean, there's no particular way in which they look the same. So what we're going to have to do if we're going to look at the anatomy is find a way to compare the two. Now, this is typical in forensic science, that you're presented with two objects that appear to be very different. And what you want to do is find a way to calibrate the two so that you can make some sort of comparisons, even though the two objects look different. So I think the obvious way to start is to say to ourselves, what is it? What are the fundamental components of the anatomies of integers? And what are, we're going to have some fun here with me traipsing over, but the fundamental components of permutations. So let's start with permutations. So we'll talk about permutations on n letters. So typically I'll write sigma in Sn for permutations on n letters. And of course there's n factorial permutations, but well, how do you write down a permutation? What are the fundamental components of a permutation? Well, actually it's easier to work with integers. Let me start with integers and go back. Let me take the integers, and you'll use little n for an integer up to x, and think about how do we break down an integer into fundamental components? Well, that's easy. It's the prime factors, right? So fundamental components is the prime factors. So, well, let's go back to thinking about permutations. What are the fundamental components of a permutation? Well, you can always write down a permutation as a product of cycles, right? And there's a unique way to do that. So the fundamental components are the cycles. Okay, so you've all seen, everybody's seen, you write down, here's a permutation, means 1 goes to 2, 2 goes to 1, 3 goes to 5, 5 goes to 4, 4 goes to 3. So those are the fundamental components, and I guess if we're going to find a way to compare the two, maybe we should compare the fundamental components. And perhaps one way to do it is to say, well, how rare are objects that are just the fundamental components? So how rare are primes amongst integers up to x? Well, there's a very deep theorem which says that 1 in log x of the integers up to x are prime. Okay, so that's the prime number theorem. We don't get into it, but it's just the fact that if you take a random integer up to x, and the probability that it's going to be prime is about 1 over log x. Well, you can ask what proportion of the permutations on n letters are cycles. Well, that's pretty easy, because to get a complete cycle, an n cycle, you're going to take 1, and it's got to shift to something else, n minus 1 possibilities. Wherever it's shifted to, that's got to shift to something other than itself and 1, so there's n minus 2 possibilities. You keep on going, n minus 1 factorial possibilities out of n factorial permutations, that's 1 in n. So we get 1 in n permutations in Sn are cycles. Okay, so here's a guess at how we can calibrate things. Whenever we see an n over here, if these things are to be calibrated somehow and to be compared, we should hope to see a log x over here. Well, I know it sounds stupid, but let's just go with it. So, what can we ask about permutations and integers to try and understand them? Well, and if you have, you can think of these components maybe as the bones of a body. You might ask, how many bones does a body have? Okay, or how many fundamental components would you expect a typical permutation to have? So it turns out, this theorem, it's in Feller, which was mentioned earlier, one of the standard probability books, that a typical permutation has about log n cycles. Okay, so I'm using a lot of language loosely, quite on purpose, because we don't want to get too technical. But a typical permutation has log n cycles. Probability 1, you're going to be pretty close to log n cycles. So by probability 1, of course, I mean 1 minus something going to 0 as n goes to infinity. So, well, if this, if I'm not talking complete nonsense, then if our calibration makes any sense, what would we expect? We'd expect something like a typical integer has about, well, replacing n by log x, we get log log x prime factors. Is this true? Well, this is actually the first result, I guess, that Ramanujan proved after he moved to England. He proved with Hardy that almost all integers have up to x have about log log x prime factors. So at least on this first statement, we see the calibration works. Well, that's kind of not much. So, well, I mean, we said log n, but what do I mean by that? What is the distribution of cycles in permutations? So I run through the permutations on n letters. And what I want to ask is, you know, what is the distribution of the number of cycles, like log n minus 10 or log n minus 20? How many do we have at each number? Well, a rough guide to that would be just to take the permutations on n letters and draw a little histogram and have a look at it. And lo and behold, just like in the last lecture, you see a normal curve come up. And in fact, what you find is the distribution is normal with mean. Well, we've already said what the mean is. It's going to be log. Well, more or less said what the mean is. But and variance actually turns out to be the same thing, about log n. So that's the distribution of the number of cycles in a permutation. You got mean log n and variance log n, which means standard deviation root log n, or within 95% probability, or within 1.96 times root log n. Okay, so let's see what next. So over here, if we try to compare, it should say distribution is normal with mean and variance. Again, we got to replace n by log x about log log x. Well, this is the result that's known as gives the birth of probabilistic number theory. It's the Erdős-Katz theorem that says exactly this. So, at least at first sight, we're seeing, at least it's not complete nonsense trying to compare the two. Okay, let's try something else. Of course, when you're looking at a body, you're not just interested in how many bones are in the body, but where they're positioned. Okay, if you're going to compare two organisms. So, how are oh well if you didn't get that last line, it's gone. So how do you look at what's the distribution, if you like, of the cycles of a permutation, or the cycle lengths of permutation, so within the permutation? Well, I've got to make some sense to that, so let me write down the cycle lengths inside a permutation. So that would be, I guess, I'm going to order them D1, D2, to DL. Those are going to be my cycle lengths. And, of course, they're going to be between 1 and n. In fact, they're going to sum up to n, right, the cycle lengths. And what I said is that usually, typically, L is about log n. And again, because we said we had normal distribution with standard deviation about square root log n, we really mean very close to log n most of the time. So how do you compare log n, how do you look at log n numbers inside an interval of length n between 1 and n? Well, it's kind of tricky. But, you know, if you just think, well, what would make life easy, which, you know, if you're an experimental science, that's what you do. So you just say, okay, let's take the logs. So we take these numbers. Logarithms of a cycle length, and there, very conveniently, between 0 and log n, and there's log n of them. So that sounds more like something you can ask a question about, like how are they distributed, log n numbers in an interval of length log n. Are they all bunched up at one end or another? Are they somehow smoothly distributed across the whole interval? So, part of the problem with this question is just how to formulate it in a decent mathematical term. If you were one thing to look at distribution over an interval is a probability theorist, and you probably want to use something like Poisson point process, but of course we're not sampling in from an infinite population, so we have that problem arising here. So what I'm going to do is try and formulate what I want to say as a mathematician without getting my tongue twisted by Poisson stuff. So what is it I want to say to think of a set of numbers in an n, let's say L numbers in an interval of length L, and I want to say they're randomly distributed. So suppose I've got L, so I'll think of L as very large, L numbers in an interval of length L, and I'll think of L as being very large. So if I want to think of them as randomly distributed, or I'll use the word Poisson, and you'll see why in a second if you're familiar with Poisson distributed, with the Poisson distribution. So here's the idea I'm going to take is, well, okay, if they're sort of randomly distributed, you should expect an average spacing of 1, right? There's L numbers in full length L. So what would we expect for an interval of length, say, lambda? Interval length lambda. Ooh, you know, I've written this really badly. Let me put it such that the interval length is lambda. And we could ask, how often would we expect k of our numbers in the interval? So let me try and phrase this a little better. I've got this very, very long interval L, and lambda's some fixed number, say 2, 2.7, and I'm going to look at random intervals of length 2.7, somewhere in my interval of length L, and I'm going to ask, how often do I get 3 of my numbers in that interval, exactly 3? And if things were Poisson distributed, you'd expect something like e to the minus lambda, lambda to the k over k factorial. Okay, so that's what I'm going to mean by Poisson distributed. I randomly select intervals, and then I ask for what I expect. And the answer is this randomly? So what I want is that this should be true for a range of values of lambda from minus an an arbitrary small interval to an arbitrary large interval, and for any integer k, that this should be true. And then I'm going to call it Poisson distributed. And so is this Poisson distributed? Yes. Poisson distributed in this sense. So you take the log of a cycle length between 0 and log n, and you say, I take short intervals inside there, and I ask, how often do I get k of these cycle lengths in there? The answer is what you guess if they're randomly distributed. Now, let me ask the same question over here. So, I guess I'm going to have to take my prime factors of n. Will be p1 less than or equal to p2 less than or equal to pl. Those are going to be my prime factors of n. Now, let's see. When I compare n, my integer n, what we said over here was, let's see, we take our capital N and we compare it to, like, logarithm over there. Okay, so that sort of suggests that if we're going to take these cycle lengths, di, we should probably compare them to log pi over here. Okay, I mean, the cycle lengths add together to give you the total amount, and the logarithms of the size of the prime factors add together to give you log n. So here we looked at log d1 through log dl. Well, perhaps over here we should look at, well, what would log di correspond to? Log pi. So now I'm going to look at log p1, log p2, up to log pl. And, well, again, this should be less, if n is up to less than or equal to x, log pl will be less than or equal to log n, will be less than or equal to log x. The smallest prime is 2, so this is certainly greater than or equal to log 2. So here we now have, I said before, the theorem of Harding-Ramanujan said we typically get log prime factors of an integer. And So when we take log-log of the primes, we've got log-log numbers in an interval of length log-log x, roughly. And we can ask the same question. Are these numbers Poisson distributed? And the answer is yes. Okay, so what have we seen? We've seen that in our attempt to make a rather strange claim that the anatomies of permutations and integers should at least be compared, that when we set up the correct calibration, that looks pretty good. Well, I don't know. I mean, you can be cynical about it, right? I mean, it's a very odd thing to do. And I think my primary reason I'd be cynical is that about everything I've just said is that things have got to have some distribution, so why shouldn't they look random? Right? I mean, I've said everything looks random. They've got normal distributions here and Poisson there, and hey, things have got to happen somehow. So we all know that things that objects in mathematics tend to distribute according to well-known distributions, particularly normal and Poisson distributions. So maybe this isn't evidence of anything at all except their objects are counting. So if we really want to prove that something's going on here, I guess what we really want to do is say, is there something weird about cycle lengths? Is there something weird about the distribution of prime factors that they share in common? Okay, that would be better evidence than something that every mathematical object probably has, or many of them. So let's think. We've looked at how many cycles a permutation has, and we've looked at how are those cycles distributed, at least the logarithm length of those cycles. But we haven't looked more specifically, for instance, at how big is the largest cycle? Okay, so let's ask that. So we've got the cycle lengths as L cycle lengths up to N. We could ask, what's the probability if we choose a permutation at random that all of the cycle lengths are less than a half times N? Okay, so let me phrase that. So what's the probability that DL is less than or equal to, say, beta times n. So I'll fix beta between 0 and 1, and such that sigma is in Sn. Okay, so I pick a random permutation. I ask, what's the probability? And it turns out as n goes to infinity, this does tend to some sort of probability, and I'm going to denote the probability as rho of 1 over beta. So let me tell you about this function rho. So rho is a function that is, well, it's not very hard to define between 0 and 1, but let me define it for you, but for u greater than 1. So here's a definition of rho. You define it for u greater than 1 by an integral delay equation, which sort of equation that comes into many subjects. There's sort of a time delay here that the value at u is some sort of average over previous history. Well, you can give several definitions of rho, but none of them are very simple. I mean, they're all something. They're not just like this is log of something or something nice and simple. They're always something that's rather implicit functioning. I mean, you've got to do something. You can do it as a time delay. You can do it as double Laplace transforms of complicated things. It's a non-trivial function. There's not a simple way to write down rho. This is about as simple as it gets. I mean, one of the things, for instance, rho is obviously a positive value function since it's a probability, and it decays faster than 1 over gamma u. So typically, as fast function as you get in pure mathematics, it decays faster. So it's a peculiar function, and it's this probability. Now, what's the equivalent question over there? We saw with DL, the cycle length, the longest cycle length, we should compare it to log of the largest prime factor, being less than or equal to, so log of the largest prime factor was what would replace DL, and that should be less than or equal to beta times n, which corresponds to log x. So when you look at that, you say, well, I've got to take powers, exponential of both sides. So I could ask, what's the probability that the lth largest prime factor of an integer is, or the largest prime factor integer, rather, is less than or equal to, well, let me just write it this way, less than or equal to n to the beta. It's essentially the same thing, if n is your integer. Okay, and as you look at the set of integers n, maybe I should leave it in the same form so it's not confusing. Let me just say x to the beta running over the integers n up to x. So you take a random integer up to x and you ask, what's the probability that the largest prime factor is less than x to the beta? As x goes to infinity, this tends to a certain probability. It's the same function rho of 1 over beta. So now you start to get interesting because you say, well, why on earth should these two objects of mathematics that are so different come up with a fundamental question, how big's the longest cycle, with a function that's got a very transcendental definition, and yet it's the same function. So maybe it was just lucky. So let's ask, what about the largest two prime factors and the largest two cycles? There's probably some distribution function for those. Well, they're the same. Or the largest three, or the largest four. Well, they're all the same. Okay, well, let's move on and say, what about the smallest prime factors or the smallest cycle? What's the probability that the smallest cycle, say, is greater than or equal to alpha times n? Such that sigma is in Fn. Does that tend to some sort of probability as n tends to infinity? Well, you'll see why I'm a bit uncomfortable about what I'm going to write in a second. So what this tends to is, well, actually, what you have to do, you see, is put alpha n in the denominator for the probability. So what I'm saying is this probability is going to get closer and closer to something with an alpha n in the denominator, and there's going to be some function omega of 1 over alpha on the top. And if I ask the same question here, what's the probability that the smallest prime factor of an integer is greater than or equal to x to the alpha? Then it tends to also 1 over alpha times over log of x to the alpha. Exactly the analogous statement when we do our calibration. And here, omega is also a peculiar function. In some sense, it's irrelevant what it is. What's relevant is simply that these are transcendentally defined functions. You see they're not entirely dissimilar. There's a theory of that. Okay, so when we ask for the smallest prime factor of an integer, or the largest prime factor of an integer, or the joint distribution of the k smallest or the k largest, we get the same answers as we get for permutations, and the answer is something highly non-trivial. I mean, it's even hard to compute these things. So we start to see the anatomies look the same in ways that are perhaps not entirely just what, you know, any old thing would have just because it exists. So okay, so I didn't really stop for any questions at all. Has anybody got any comments or questions? Cynicism? Yeah. No. Well, let me say why no, because that's a good question. So you have that log n cycles here. So really what we're looking at is, how do I want to say this most easily? So basically we're looking in, I don't quite know how to say this correctly, but the scale is wrong. So in some sense you're looking that there's one outlier is not going to affect the distribution function when you're talking about lots of things. I guess that's what I'm trying to say. Yeah. So that's why looking at this finer distribution is a really different question. Yeah. Well, let's go to that later. You actually believe me, huh? That they're the same. Okay, well, let's suppose that George is more cynical than he is. Sorry, did you want to say something else? Aha! Such faith. Okay. Ooh. Okay, so let's suppose you were more cynical than people here, and you said, well, okay, you've talked about the typical elements of these populations. I mean, there's a lot of permutations around that. You've been talking about typical permutations, and you've been talking about typical integers. What happens for almost all integers? But, you know, maybe everything's the same in the middle somehow, but if you looked at permutations with lots of cycles, maybe they're different from integers with lots of prime factors. Maybe, or maybe not. So let's have a look at that question. And see if I pull the fast one. Okay. So let me ask about... permutations on L letters with exactly L cycles. So now I'm not talking necessarily L being log N, and I'm going to do the same thing over here, integers up to X with exactly L prime factors, and again, I'm not necessarily going to be talking about exactly log log X. Good question. It's a choice. So everything I'm going to say could be said with multiplicity, and it could also be said without multiplicity. Maybe there's slight differences in how you'd say it. Okay. They're not significant, the differences in the questions I'm going to address. Well, it's not quite true, but I'll make a comment. Okay. So we saw most permutations have about log n cycles, and we actually said how many have one cycle. We said it's one in n, right? So what's the probability, say, that we have L cycles in the permutation? Exactly L cycles. And that's roughly 1 over n. Well, okay, that's not entirely surprising. It's rather beautiful because we get something like this. So if you wanted to ask what's the probability the permutation on n letters has three cycles, exactly, it would be the 1 over n, and then you get log n squared over 2 factorial. And this is true for L up to, well, let's say epsilon times log n, where epsilon's pretty small. Okay, so that's not quite the region where we expect most permutations. Most permutations have log n cycles. So if you're asking for significantly less than log n cycles, then you get something very pretty because, well, it looks a bit like Poisson with parameter log n, right? Yeah, you get that log n to the L minus 1 over L. If it's, you could sum that up and you get 1. So that would be, it would be a perfect theory, but it's not true, however, that perfect theory. So there's a theorem, and I haven't mentioned a lot of authors here, and I'm sorry about that, but there are, not only there are infinitely many, but you have the Russian West dichotomy here. It's not entirely clear who proved what, and especially about permutations. Things seem to be improved maybe before in Russia than in the West, but certainly independently. So it's not entirely clear who deserves credit for what. Anyway, there's this theorem that says, well, what happens when L gets a bit bigger? So what turns out when L is a little bit bigger is you've got to multiply this by, well, the classical gamma function, where tau is L minus 1 over log n. So, and this will be for L up to about log squared n. So what I'm saying is, what's the probability you get exactly L cycles? It's going to be the sort of Poisson thing times a little correction factor, 1 over the classical gamma function. Now, classical gamma function, these are real at real points, and gamma grows like the factorial function, right? So gamma of an integer r plus 1 is r factorial. So let me just look at the most interesting point. So if l is less than epsilon log n, then tau would be less than epsilon. So that was pretty small. Then, so gamma of 1 plus tau would be about gamma of 1, which is 1. So now let's have a look at the other case that's sort of most obvious to explore, which is when l is about log n, right, which is where you get most things. What is tau then? Tau's about 1, and the correction factor is 1 over gamma 2. And gamma 2 is also 1. So it's very odd. So naturally, people conjectured this was always true, which got in the way of actually proving the general formula, because at the two places it's obvious to look, the correction factor is 1. Strangely. Nowhere else is it 1, by the way. It's only those two points. But anyway, I think this is proved by Huang. But I'm not sure. Okay, so what is the analogy then? What's the probability that an integer has L prime factors? And so what would be the analogous formula? 1 over log x, log x. This is just replacing n by log x for L less than epsilon log x. Okay, and this is a theorem of Landau from about 100 years ago. And then you can ask what happens as things get a little bit bigger. And you have to multiply through by the same correction factor. Of course, here, L minus 1 over log x. Okay? This is, but there's another correction factor. There's one more. And here it is. So it's a product over all primes. So you can now tell we're doing number theory, finally. Of 1 plus tau over p minus 1 times 1 minus 1 over p to the tau. So you think, oh my gosh, finally, they're different. Well, are they? Are they so different? So, you know, if you're doing anatomy, you've got to look, you're looking at the insides and what's really happening inside, and there are some superficialities that are different. Yeah, I mean, you may be looking at two twins, and one's dyed their hair, one's broken their nose. They look different. So the question is, how much of a superficial difference is this, or is this a real difference between the two? So let me start off by saying, I'm thinking about what happens when tau equals 0 and tau equals 1, the two most interesting cases. When tau equals 0, what is this correction factor? It's 1. When tau equals 1, it's p over p minus 1 times p minus 1 over p. It's 1 again. So it has the amazing property that the correction factor disappears at exactly those points again, which was a problem for the number theorists in working this thing out. And then you might ask, well, what about for the other values of tau, where maybe it's not 1, in fact, it's never else. Nowhere else is it 1. Well, the truth is that this product only really depends on the very small primes, less than about tau squared, which is typically very, very small. So if you think of maybe the prime factors 2, 3, 5, 7 being fairly superficial aspects of an integer, whether or not they divide the integer, and I'm going to make that argument they are superficial, then this turns out to have not a great deal of effect and be a fairly superficial aspect. Okay, so if you'll allow me that, which you may not, I see great skepticism in Valentine's eyes, but anyway, then there's still a compelling analogy between the two. So I should say that this is an interesting theorem in its own right of history. It was first proved by Sate in India in two 50 or 60 page papers of overwhelming combinatorics. And a young Selberg, when asked to referee the paper, said, well, but isn't it obvious just by using a little complex analysis? So the literature is called the Selberg-Sate theorem, and what happened, I believe, is that, well, Selberg's referee's report is published in the literature. So it's just 4 pages. It's a wonderful lesson how to use complex analysis to do number theory. And it's a paper I always give to a new graduate student to see whether or not they can do the subject. If they can figure out Selberg's referee's report, then they're okay. So anyway, so it's a strange theorem. Proved by two people, one in 128 pages, one in four. So let's see. I guess I have about 10 more minutes. Is that right? Okay, so what about bigger than log squared? So these are both true, sort of, in this region. There's some caveats, but I won't get into them. But what I want to do is talk about larger L, which turn out to be much more difficult. So what about if you have permutations on N letters with L cycles, say where L is N to the 1/10th. So you've got an enormous number of cycles. Can you give a nice estimate for the probability that you have N to the 1/10th cycles? Is it possible to give a nice formula? And the answer is, rather perhaps surprisingly, no, it's not possible. And let me justify what I mean by that. So if you're very good at analysis, as some people are, then you can set about saying, okay, no question like this is going to defeat me, and I'll go and give a formula for the number of permutations on N letters with exactly L cycles. And as I say here, I'm thinking of L being very large, say N to the 1/10th. And you go ahead, you set up some sort of integral, you shift contours, this is the typical behavior of these type of analysts, and you know, you see some major contribution, get rid of the contours that don't matter, and you hope it's all going to work out. Well, you do get some sort of formula, but it turns out it's one of those formulas you can't really simplify. You get, here's the value, but it's a function of a saddle point. And I can estimate the saddle point more and more accurately, and then I can plug it into my formula, but I don't get a very satisfying, smooth, pretty formula. I just get some complicated function evaluated at a saddle point. So you can call it a solution, or you can say, well, gosh, I didn't know how to deal with that. So so I should say the history of these two subjects are almost entirely separate until recently. There's analogous theorems in the two subjects, and the analogous problems came up, and people dealt with them in analogous ways. So in the permutation side, there's a famous paper for people in combinatorics by Moser and Wyman from 1958. It's on Stirling numbers of the first kind, which is actually the same question in disguise. And they realized something rather interesting, which was, okay, you can get this formula in terms of this nastily defined saddle point. It's really difficult to work with, and you can't work with it. But what you can do with it is say, what if we shifted the parameters a bit? Can we compare the two saddle points? Can we estimate one saddle point in terms of the other? Turns out you can do that very well. So let me give you one of the consequences of Moser and Wyman's work. If L and N over L go to infinity, then we're going to define an awful variable, N over L log N over L. That'll be mu. And then the probability that we take a permutation, I always get this the wrong way around. So I'm going to take a permutation on N minus M letters, and it has L minus 1 cycles. So it's on N minus M letters. Over the probability that we take a permutation on L cycles, and it has N letters, and we can get a nice asymptotic for that. Not a problem, turns out. So a comparative formula, you can get a nice, pretty comparative formula, whatever it is. And this was one of the realizations of Moser and Wyman, which was very helpful for various questions in that area of combinatorics. And quite recently, Hildebrand Tenenbaum did something very similar in the number theory question. And So this is sigma has L cycles such that sigma is an Sn. So the probability that tau has L minus 1 cycles, so that tau, there's an M there that's very suspicious. Okay, well, I've written it down wrong. So there exists a formula, I just haven't written it down correctly. I'm not going to recover it now. Just have to trust me on this. Damn. No, I'm the one who's missing something. Never mind. Okay, so... okay, so over here, you can do the same thing with log x, if it's new, and then there exists a formula in exactly the same way, if only I'd written it down correctly. I have a feeling it's to the power n, but I'm not sure. But. Okay, anyway, so the point, of course, is that if I ask the analogous question here, which is going to be the proportion of integers up to x over d with exactly l minus 1 prime factors over the proportion of integers up to x with exactly l prime factors, no, it can't be to the power n. Then we get some formula. Okay. One day I'll correct the paper on my website and you'll know if you really want to know what that formula is. It is the same formula. Okay, so I'll rush to the end. So you can continue asking questions of this sort. So for instance, before we asked of typical integers, is the layout of a prime factors the same? And we discussed this idea of a Poisson distribution on an interval. Well, with suitable reformulation, one can ask the same question in both these cases, and one finds that there's a suitable Poisson distribution. So the reformulation involves things like, if you've got two log x prime two log n cycles, you're going to have this interval length log n, then there should be a Poisson distribution parameter 1/2, not parameter 1. So you have to adjust things accordingly. Similarly over there. So there's a couple more things to take into account, but I'm thinking about time. I probably won't go into them, trust me. When you take them into account, you can come up with the same distributions. You can ask about the largest and smallest part. So let me ask this question, actually. It's kind of fun. Okay, so I said a typical permutation has log n cycles, right? And we had some weird distribution function for the largest cycle. Now, let's increase the number of cycles. Let's suppose we have 10 log n cycles. Should the largest cycle be smaller or bigger? So, okay, if we've got 10 log n cycles instead of log n cycles, we've got more cycles. So you've got to get more squished into adding up to n. So maybe the largest one should be smaller. On the other hand, you've got more cycles. So maybe one of them's going to be big. Which one is it? Well, you do the calculation, turns out the largest one is going to get, any guesses? Smaller. Okay, typically, the largest cycle will get smaller. Typically, the largest prime factor will get smaller, the more prime factors you have. How do the distribution functions of those things work? They're identical. Okay, so, that's probably enough to say that in almost every aspect, other than a few peripheral pieces of information, you get the same distribution of all the questions I could think of. If you've got a good question, I'd love to hear it, because we'll try and compute and see if they're the same. So George's question now comes up. Why do integers and permutations seemingly have the same structure? Why do they seemingly have the same anatomy? So if you look at the literature, you can find two so-called explanations. One by some probability theorists, and two by some analysts. So the probability theorists are led by Arafia, Barber, and Tavare. You may have seen a good article, Notices, about 10 years ago. And they come up with probabilistic models that attempt to explain everything. Well, it kind of explains everything where you have exactly log n cycles and you have exactly log prime factors. But when you try and use their model in these more delicate questions where you say, what about two log n cycles? Well, I can't see how to make their methods work. And when I wrote to them, I didn't get a response that led me to believe I can make them work. So take that as you want. So you might think that there's an overriding probabilistic model you could fit everything into, but it's not obvious that there is to me. Then to one person I think is here, Panario, maybe in the computer science department?
He's in Ottawa.
Ottawa, okay. And Bruce Richmond, who I know is at Waterloo. They said, okay, well, a lot of the, not all of his stuff, but a lot of his stuff you can sort of do by looking at generating functions. And so they said, let's try and get some sort of generalized generating function that implies a lot of this information. And some of this information comes out of their technique, and some of it doesn't. In fact, some of the more surprising ones don't. But so what they've created is a technique that's very useful for actually avoiding calculating a lot of things, because they've got nice general theorems, but it's not an explanation either. So it seems like there's, I've come up with about 15 things that the two, I mean, in literature, maybe 10 of these properties were known on one and 8 on the other, and then I just went around proving the ones from either side. So it turns out anything you can think about anatomy seems to be more or less the same. And I don't have a very good explanation. There was, however, I gave a talk on this about a year ago in England, and Vershik from St. Petersburg happened to be at this meeting. He's a probabilist, and he came up to me afterwards and he said, you obviously weren't at my ICM lecture. So he said to me, the real question is, how do mathematical objects organize themselves? And he, in his ICM lecture in 94, showed that there's about, in many, many structures across mathematics, he mostly to do with probability and combinatorics, but he came up with about 7 basic structures and found large quantities of objects that fit into those structures. Again, not as detailed as here, not as going away from the usual size of things, but he found a lot of things that are very similar. And this is a notion that's come up spectacularly in number theory recently in the theory of L functions. So very recently, in the last 10 years, it's sort of a notion from quantum chaos that when you try to model energy levels of operators that occur, you find that the distribution of those energy levels seem to be modeled very, very well by the distribution of eigenvalues taken from random matrices, taken from certain groups and only a few groups. There's not lots and lots of groups, just a few groups will do. And it turns out when you look at zeros of L functions that it's amazing that the models are so good and they come from random matrices from a very small number of classical groups. Again, the question of why, there's no why. It's just these models work. It's great. Occasionally you can prove something. So am I out of time? I'm out of time. Well, let me just finish with one, two more words. Had a nice minute. So I put actually a preprint on the web about 3 weeks ago, and I've already received a preprint from a graduate student who had heard that you could do similar things for polynomials over finite fields, and he proved several of these things for polynomials over finite fields. Well, some of this was known, some of it wasn't. And so we find, actually, I can name you, but I won't, about 8 or 9 different mathematical objects that have similar anatomies. I haven't tested all the properties because it's a lot of work. But just like in the Oscars last night, if you watched it, it was a politically correct occasion because Al Gore was there and they gave him an Oscar and they told the world how green they are. So at this lecture, we're coming to a politically correct conclusion. Also, that mathematical organisms are all the same under the skin, as long as you ignore the peripherals. Their structures, anatomies, even the most minute details, seem to be more or less identical, one no better or worse than the other. If we look at the vast array of mathematical organisms, then we see there are a small number of different possibilities. And within each possibility, there are many mathematical organisms whose anatomies are far more similar than the differences that distinguish them.